This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio and streaming Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Today, we're going to start our show talking about an organization that's pretty new in Bismarck, and it's similar to others that have popped up elsewhere in the state and across the country, encouraging entrepreneurs and small businesses to work together for the common good. Ashton Hoff joins us. She's the founder of Makewell. Thanks for joining us, Ashton.
Yes, thanks so much for having me.
Just a little more background. I offered a sort of a rough description here. What is Makewell?
Yes, your description was pretty spot on, but Makewell is a community of makers of the Midwest. So we have about 1,000 makers in our community across Montana, the Dakotas, Minnesota, and Wyoming. And it's really just to elevate the creativity of makers across our region, whether it's the fine arts, to baristas, to teachers that are being innovative. We just want to highlight that creativity.
What's your background?
My trade is in graphic design.
And what prompted you to start this organization?
Yeah, so I grew up in Bismarck. I'm a Bismarck native. And then I went to Minneapolis to study graphic design, and I thought that was going to be my home. But of course, things drew me back home, and so I started working here in Bismarck in 2015. And I was super connected to the design community and the creative community in Minneapolis. And so when I moved home, I was immediately seeking out, you know, where are my people? Where are those that I can collaborate and kind of meet up with? And after some searching, I just really couldn't find my tribe. I couldn't find that group of people. And so I finally got the courage to express my idea and ask if that was a struggle to some other colleagues of mine. And the response was overwhelmingly yes, that everyone felt that same pain. And so then together with a group of some friends, we made our first event. And that kind of went off from there.
How long ago was that first event?
Our first event was in February of 2017.
So a couple of years and plus now.
Yeah.
And you have 1,000 makers spread over these several states. How do you assemble them? How did they come to you?
Yeah, so with the creative community, it's been super supportive and very word of mouth. We have a few large gatherings throughout the year. Our kind of homecoming event is every February, like that first one was. But then we also have a really strong online presence, so people can connect with us in our Facebook community group. They can stay updated on a newsletter. We have a mentorship program that spans all of those distances. So it's kind of a combination of in-person gatherings, but also really empowering anyone of any size community to get connected online.
And you have something coming up on Saturday, November 2nd, the Maker Award Show.
Yeah, we're super excited about this. We've been wanting to do an award show since the beginning to really spotlight all of those individuals that might not have that industry award show available to them, or maybe they can't afford the ticket price to go. And so we're so excited to have our first ever Maker Award Show next Saturday, where we'll be awarding 11 different makers from our community.
And how were these makers chosen?
Great question. So we really wanted to avoid any kind of bias that our team might have. So we took public nominations. We received 120 plus nominations from the community, where they were just loyal fans or family or friend members that just wanted to support a maker. And then from there, we kind of categorized it by industry so we could find industry expert judges to judge the musicians, the baristas, the food category, if you will, because we wanted them to have that expert opinion, because I certainly don't know anything about cooking. And then from there, we kind of got scores from those judges, and that's how we had our final selection.
The tickets are $15 to $85. Why that range?
Sure. So there's two different ticket types. $15 is general admission, and that gets you into the event and can enjoy the full evening. And then we also have a VIP ticket. That's that $85 point where you get a box seat and you get to attend an exclusive social hour before the event with all of the awarded nominees.
It runs from 7 to 10 Saturday, November 2nd at the Belle Mayhus Auditorium in downtown Bismarck. You can find out more about the event at wearemakewell.com. And, of course, you can get the tickets there as well. Describe the event, though, in terms of it's got sort of a different vibe to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, we wanted to be a little bit more casual than your typical red carpet award show, but still something that we can get dressed up for and celebrate. So we're doing it in late night talk show style. We have a really hilarious host named Jordan Loftus. He's a writer by trade, and he's just so entertaining. So he'll be interviewing each of the awarded makers on stage, just like you'd see Jimmy Fallon or some other host kind of interviewing them. And then we also have a live band that'll be, you know, reacting to the conversation, and then we also have a magic show that'll be our intermission.
All right. Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Is Jordan a member of Makewell?
He is. He was actually one of our speakers at our event in 2018, so he's definitely a part of the tribe.
Now, let's talk a bit about small businesses and entrepreneurship and that, and the need for an organization like this. Give us a sense of the struggle it is to, you know, start from nothing and make something.
Yeah, I think the biggest pain that we see in all small businesses, entrepreneurs, freelancers, is just that isolation that can happen, especially being in rural communities. We can feel like we're kind of on our own island and doing things and tackling things, and we naturally have this really strong work ethic. So our natural instinct is to just work harder and harder, which is great, and that gets us far and gets us success. But at the end of the day, we still need those people to rally behind us. And so I think something like Makewell or Womanly Cups or the other groups that you mentioned really allows them to find that community that can be really their voice and kind of their hype man, if you will.
And for people who are makers who want to share a craft or an ability that inspires them, the struggle is always to make a living from it.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yep. And so when we found that when we bring people together that are willing to be vulnerable and willing to share their past experiences and some of those lessons learned that they might not want to repeat, that really helps people activate, you know, how do I make money doing what I love? What is it going to take? What tools do I need? What are some things I can avoid doing that you've done in the past? And so those conversations are really where the value is.
We mentioned the website, wearemakewell.com. You said you have a Facebook presence as well. So how do these conversations go on? How often do you get together? How do you communicate? How do you deal with issues that are common to entrepreneurs or craftspeople?
Yeah, we have a few annual events that happen every single year. Like I said, our largest one is every February. That one is a gathering over 100 makers where we have kind of breakout conversations after a speaker will present on a certain topic. So we can kind of have those really focused conversations that are really intentional. We've had a couple workshop marathons where it's a full day of 10 workshops. And then in between, it's that intentional time of meeting one another and chatting about issues that are at hand. In the summer, we do house concerts, so it's a really casual evening in a neighborhood's backyard where we can just gather around a musician and, again, just talk about life. And then our other event is our annual retreat. That's kind of our weekend deep dive getaway where people can be super intentional at the end of the year in December to set goals and refocus on 2020. And so there's those in-person different opportunities where people can really have those really important conversations.
Is this kind of like a club in a way? People identify with each other?
I mean, it's a welcoming club, if you will, where people just naturally relate if they're in that season of life where they're trying to grow or build something. But it's definitely open to everyone.
Okay, so we're not looking for a lapel pin or something like
that. Oh, no. I mean, we definitely we're very generous with our swag and stickers and T-shirts to make you feel welcome. But
how,
yeah.
How are you funded? How do you sustain this?
So we are probably 50% by our ticket sales, and then also 50% we have to fundraise from really generous partners. So it's kind of a combination of community support and people attending our events.
And I guess, are you sustaining yourself as part of this, your job, or is it, are you a graphic designer?
My day job is still doing graphic design. I have a design studio with a couple others called The Good Kids, so that's where you can find me during the day. And then this is kind of my own side hustle night project.
Well, in lots of communities, and I'm thinking of Fargo-Moorhead, where they have this sort of synergy going on with a lot of local entrepreneurs and people who are small business developers.
Mm-hmm.
They want to get the community behind the local business. That's always the struggle. There are plenty of big boxes out there, all kinds of franchises.
Mm-hmm.
But this is that individual or that small group enterprise that is the toughest thing almost to get off the ground. So how is Bismarck Mandan supporting this?
I mean, Bismarck Bannon's been an amazing community. I think that's what I've been most impressed with since the beginning and since I voiced that idea. I've just had countless people come beside me and say, how can we make this happen? How can we support these individuals? And since then, the community's just really grown. Oftentimes for our events, we have local vendors, so we get to hire the people that we want to serve. And so it's this really cool trifecta of building the ecosystem and making our community a better place to live and work.
How about the Chamber of Commerce?
Yeah, we've definitely partnered with the Chamber of Commerce. We worked with them especially closely last year, where they kind of invested into some initiatives across the state, and they kind of helped us do some of those larger events.
And does the organization enjoy sort of the financial support? You know, when you approach a bank and you ask for, you know, a loan or some sort of money to get an enterprise going, is the community sensitive to that?
Sure. I haven't personally had to go to the bank and ask for a loan. I've kind of built some things to fund other projects while I'm working them at the same time. But we've definitely connected with some local banks that love working with small businesses.
Give us a sense of the range of enterprises that are covered by MakeWill, the different kinds of makers. You mentioned teachers and musical groups and things like that, but give us sort of an A to Z idea here.
Yeah, so we have people of all ages, college students all the way up to retired folks. We actually have a podcast and we interviewed Dorothy of Dot's Pretzels. And
she
started her business when she was retired. And so we have a full spectrum of entrepreneurs. And it's really cool to see the variety of industries and makers that we have represented. Like I said, we have the teachers, the entrepreneurs, the community builders, even dentists and chiropractors have gotten involved.
Great.
And then we have more of your classic designers, photographers, filmmakers. So it's a full spectrum.
So this upcoming event, it's not just for makers. It's anybody who wants to attend, right?
Exactly. We really wanted to invite the entire community, make it really accessible and just a fun late night talk show environment so that everyone can get together and realize what talent that we have locally.
And the Belle May Hoos will hold a few people.
Yes, it holds a lot of people, so there's definitely a seat for you.
Okay. Do you have any stories that when you meet people on the street and you say, this is what MakeWill is about, do you offer any anecdotes or stories about how this has worked for other people?
You know, the stories that I hear from our local makers are probably the ones that are most impactful. We have stories of people attending our events and they met this one person that got them to, you know, take the leap and go full time. And then that person connected them to the resources needed to make sure that that was a sustainable decision. And so those are the conversations and the stories that I love to hear, because it's people helping people. And that's the most that we can ask for our community. And that's where the value is. So those are the ones that really get me excited.
And the Maker Awards show is coming up Saturday, November 2nd from 7 to 10 at the Belle May Hoos in downtown Bismarck. Tickets $15 to $85. WeAreMakeWill.com has that website with information as well. Ashton Hoff is the founder of MakeWill. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we speak to President Jefferson about the role of government in overseeing elected officials.
And the question is, what is impeachment? Under what circumstances is it legitimate? Who gets to decide? And have we reached that point in our national political crisis?
Join us on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Today at 11 Central, here on Prairie Public.
Many of us agree the modern healthcare system is broken.
The United States has the costliest healthcare system in the world. And despite that, we leave nearly 30 million people uninsured.
Is a single-payer system that some politicians are pushing for the right solution? Next time on Intelligence Squared U.S., the promises and pitfalls of a Medicare for All policy in America.
Intelligence Squared, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up this afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. What is the future of journalism? It's a question begging for a clear answer. In this excerpt from the Dakota Journalist podcast, host Terry Finneman asks regional journalists to ponder the direction of the profession they worked in for decades. Their discussion begins with the current state of journalism. There's innovation and opportunity, along with financial challenges and accusations of fake news. Linda Seiler of the Dickinson Press is among those concerned about the explosion of false information online and the public criticism that the media is facing.
I worry about journalism to a degree because of all the fake news things. Do people trust us like they used to? How do we keep that trust? I think it's the fake news that we keep talking about. We need to keep our trust in our reporters.
Dale Blagan of the D. Smit News said changes in technology that have opened mass communication to the general public have significantly impacted the news industry.
There's been tremendous leap in technology. We basically went from Gutenberg and movable type to computers and video cameras and tape recorders and all this other stuff. In terms of content, investigative journalism and real hard news kinds of journalism is still the lifeblood of the profession. And that's being done well by many newspapers, some television stations. The bloggers on the internet are opinion pieces, talking heads. I don't have a lot of respect for what's happening there because there isn't a system to vet what's being presented. If there's a downside, maybe there's a little too much entertaining kinds of news in both newspaper and in broadcast journalism. We get too darn hung up on what Kim Kardashian's doing with her butt. It's too shallow to last, I hope.
Marilyn Hagerty, who began working in journalism as a college student in the 1940s, also has noticed a shift in journalism content following the rapid changes in technology in recent years.
It's kind of perplexing because it is changed so fast. I think that we know everything a lot quicker than we ever imagined we would be knowing it, and that of course is a good thing. Kind of a show. News is turned into be kind of a television show, and it's just kind of hitting the highlights. I watch a lot of television news, and I'm kind of put off by some of the little just feature-ish type of things they do on the local and the national news, quick little meaningless cutie things, than a serious report of a situation in the news. But they're on there trying to make money and clearing way for ads. And so while it's faster and quicker and more colorful, it is also not in depth.
Tim Gallego said the news industry deserves criticism for reducing its local coverage.
Well, I used to travel an awful lot. I'd pick up a newspaper in Chicago and read it. Maybe get on a plane and fly to San Francisco, pick up a newspaper and read it. And I'm seeing the same content in that paper in Chicago as the one I'm picking up in San Francisco. And so what I see happening then is those newspapers, when those cities are losing their sense of community, they're not really going out and doing the stories that are important to the people that are living within the community that they're covering. They're just picking stuff off the Associated Press or off the internet or whatever, but they're all similar. And I see too much of that now.
Like others in the news industry, Gallego is also concerned about how the public now receives information.
I see people turning too much to from sources that aren't news sources, and that bothers me. I hope that doesn't become what's going to be the way we get our regular news is off of blogs and Facebook. You know, you get to the point where you see something on Facebook or in blogs, and there's no credibility there. You don't really believe what's there. And I always want to believe. When I pick up a newspaper, I want to believe what that reporter wrote in that paper, you know. I might be critical of maybe a point or two they missed, but I know that person put their heart into what they wrote. And I don't see that on Facebook. I think I see so much harm coming from these other sources.
Roger Casa, who spent over 50 years working for the Huron Plainsman, said declining trust in media concerns him.
I think the biggest change has been how people view who we are and what we do. And I think that they are extremely critical of us because we are journalists, and that's because they don't trust us. We have lost the trust of the people in many cases, and we have to work very hard to get that back again.
Seiler thinks reporters need to help combat that lack of trust by engaging more in their communities.
So I think we as reporters need to get out there on the streets. We need to get into the clubs. We need to get our faces out there so they get to know us as a person, not just a byline in the paper. And I think that's the only way we can combat that locally. We can't do much about it nationally, but that's what we can do locally.
With so much negativity surrounding the industry, some worry about its future and the ability to attract young journalists.
We need good reporters. I mean, and I think a lot of young people are shying away from the profession because they kind of look at it as a dead profession. And I don't ever see that happen. I don't know what this country would be without the reporters that are out there doing the hard work and coming up with the truth and doing the investigative things like the water situation in Flint and the cover-up of the Catholic Church in Boston. It took reporters to go in and do those hard stories, and I don't want to see us lose that.
Perhaps the most significant factor influencing the current and future state of journalism, however, boils down to one word: money. Dick Lee, a former journalism professor, saw the shift over his career.
Change has been money. The change has been money in the sense that people are not paying the same amount to get news that they once were. And part of it has been the selfishness of individuals and of stockholders. And so for years, newspapers really didn't see themselves as making loads of money. But now people see communication as a way to make money. And they're having a hard time doing it.
Bill Marseille of Forum Communications said there are a lot of misperceptions about journalism among the public. As an executive, Marseille witnessed firsthand the changes in the news industry's revenue. Forum Communications now owns about 36 newspapers in the upper Midwest. Marseille began working in advertising at the Fargo Forum in the 1960s, before growing the company and becoming its CEO and chairman.
The business side is much more difficult than it was, because I said early on, you know, newspapers were an unregulated monopoly or utility in most towns. So that's become more difficult. There's more competition out there now, and the advertisers are a lot more sophisticated than they used to be. The only show in town, they had to buy the newspaper, you know, so that's become a lot different.
For journalists, money has long been a tricky factor in an industry that prides itself on the separation of its advertising and editorial departments. In other words, reporters purposely focused in the past on serving their communities without much concern for the newspaper's finances. Now, it's impossible for newsrooms not to feel the impact of money, a fact that bothered longtime weekly publisher John Andrist.
One of my concerns, it's just become big business. It's more about making money than it is about community service. I think there's still some zeal in the hearts of man for making community service a part of our business. But I think it gets less emphasis than the business today. Another thing I despair is the concentration of media ownership. I think the thing that made journalism so wonderful in my younger years was its diversity. we're headed for a time when, who knows, maybe Walmart will own half the media outlets. And I say that not totally with tongue in cheek, you know. And whatever is wrong with journalism, however, is wrong with all of us, because it isn't just journalists who become seemingly more me-centered. I hope the next generation makes this great discovery of what's really important, because now it seems to be more about me.
I think that newspapers like the Grand Forks Herald and smaller newspapers in small towns will be around for a long time, because people in these towns know each other and they want to know about each other. And the only way they can really get what's going on, the obituaries, the weddings, those things, is by reading their local newspapers.
I worry about the little papers. Are the voices of those little papers going to be there in 10 years? I don't know that. But I think the rest of us will be around a long time.
Mary Carol Keeter now works for South Dakota Newswatch, a nonprofit launched in 2017 to provide quality journalism in the state. Prior to that, she had her own reflections on the future of journalism.
Well, if I had a crystal ball, I could make some money. I think there will always be a need for journalism. I think there will always be a need for people to ask the questions, inform the public, hold people accountable, celebrate successes in a community. I think there will always be a need for that.
Despite the turbulence in journalism in the past decade and the uncertainty over the future, experienced journalists in North Dakota and South Dakota are adamant that the industry's overall mission should remain the same.
Oh, the mission of media shouldn't be any different than it's always been. And that's to inform the people.
We have to be a watchdog on the government. Who else is going to do it? And, you know, I think people in this country now are starting to recognize the value of a responsible press. And they've recognized the bloggers and some of these fringe newspapers or internet source providers are not accurate, and you can't rely on them. So I feel comfortable with people are going to come back to the press.
Whether it's a school board, a city council, a state legislature, or Congress, it's important that we continue to put the information out there. We have to keep reporting on what's going on, analyzing what's going on, and giving people some real options, and not fall into just the talking heads flapping their lips about things. There's got to be something with more depth than that.
Media probably has the most important role there is in democracy. Without the media to cover the political arena like it is right now, the people aren't going to be able to make knowledgeable decisions. They have to have the facts in front of them in order to make decisions that's going to have an impact on their lives and the lives of their families. And without that, we're not going to survive as a nation.
That was an excerpt from the Dakota Journalist Podcast, which dives into the lives of the people who produce newspapers. It's sponsored by the Newspaper Associations of North and South Dakota. You can hear the full episodes, there are 12 of them on various themes, at dakotajournalist.podbean.com. They're also available on Spotify and iTunes.
NPR One is all about you. Handpicked public radio content based on what you like.
Who knew?
NPR One connects you to a stream of public radio news, stories, and podcasts curated especially for you.
NPR Hourly Newscasts, Prairie Public Regional News, it's all there.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
Download NPR One in the App Store now and select Prairie Public as your station.
For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
A world of customized content delivered right to your smartphone.
Okay, guys, headphones on.
The story puts you in the center of the action.
It's on whenever you're on.
NPR One is all about
you.
Download it today.
Wherever you spend your morning, NPR's Morning Edition is there with you. Wherever the story takes place, NPR's Morning Edition connects it with you.
Dallas.
Des Moines.
Topeka.
Montana.
You will own your morning when you spend tomorrow with Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton in studio with Ashley Thornburg. And joining us by phone from Southern California, Dr. Judith Orloff. She's a psychiatrist and the author of the new book, Thriving as an Empath, 365 Days of Self-Care for Sensitive People.
Dr. Orloff, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
We should probably start with definitions. What is an empath?
Yeah, so I'm a psychiatrist in Los Angeles. I'm also an empath. And what that means is I combine my traditional psychiatric training with this ability to sense very deeply, to be open to other people empathically and be an emotional sponge. So I can sense things about people, and empaths can sense things about people, but they can tend to take on the angst of the world and the stress of the world because they don't have the same filters that other people have and tend to absorb other people's energy and get either depressed, anxious, overwhelmed, unless they have self-care tools to prevent that, and then they could be empowered empaths.
So when did you come to the realization that you were an empath, and how do you think it's affected your life? Did it prompt you to become a psychiatrist, for example?
Well, as a little girl, I was very sensitive, and my parents, who were both physicians, and I have 25 physicians in my family, I come from, and they would say, oh, dear, just get a thicker skin, toughen up. And so I grew up believing there was something wrong with me, being ashamed of my sensitivities and my deep caring for animals and people and the earth. But later on, I learned that I'm an empath, and we need to embrace our gifts. In so many ways, the world needs us, but I also have to learn how to not absorb the stress of the world and not feel like it's my job to take on everybody's pain, because that's what empaths often do. And empaths wear invisible signs around them saying, I can help you. So lots of people flock to them and tell them their life stories, which can be exhausting if you don't know how to set a boundary.
Yeah, well, there's this cartoon that goes around every once in a while on social media where there's two silhouettes of people, and someone is all black, and that's obviously meant to signify depression, and then they hold hands with this empath, and the empath absorbs that blackness from this person, and then that depression, and then that sadness from the next person, the next person, the next person. And you said self-care. So how are you able to be sensitive to this and help clear that out of other people and keep yourself safe? Self-care routine.
Right. Here. That's the big question. That's the most important question, and that's why I wrote Thriving as an Empath. It's a different self-care technique every day of the year, the 365 self-care techniques on how to take care of yourself as an empath so you don't absorb other people's stress and yet you still have your empathy and your beautiful heart and your caring soul. You're able to have those in addition to feeling strong and protected and safe. And one thing is to carve out alone time. Empaths need adequate alone time. They can't be with people all the time, because then they get very exhausted. So even carving out 10 minutes a day or more, if you can, to just decrease your stimulation level, because empaths often get overstimulated by events that other people don't. And so, for instance, if I go to a social situation, I'll limit my time there to about 2 hours max or less. So I don't feel trapped, and if I want to go home, I'll give myself that permission. So that's one form of self-care. is to just limit your time in social situations and enjoy yourself and then exit before you burn out.
You talked about your childhood and being, you know, advised by people close to you to sort of buck up, you know, get a thicker skin and all that. As a psychiatrist, what kind of understanding do you have about the origin of empathy? Is it nature or nurture or some combination?
Yeah, I think some babies are born with, you know, deep empathy and sensitivities, and others are not. So part of it is temperament, part of it is upbringing, where you might have been brought up in a home that didn't really see you or get you, or it was a noisy home or a chaotic home, or you were raised by narcissistic parents or neglectful parents, and that can break down your defenses and cause your sensitivities to become heightened. Because nurturing and good parenting really helps insulate you. And without that, you're kind of left on your own in the world. And so that can lead to this incredible love and compassion, but also a rawness that needs to be dealt with.
Well, and what can happen if this empathy is not properly channeled? Are we talking depression, alcoholism?
Yeah, exhaustion. I work a lot with people in 12-step recovery programs, and they often describe themselves as recovering empaths as well.
Wow.
Because they were so sensitive, they would take a drug, take a drink, you know, sex, food, wherever you went to numb it out because it was just too much, and they didn't have skills. So part of the recovery program is learning how to practice self-care as an empath.
Well, there are extremes in all kinds of conditions, I guess. You can be too empathic, I guess, and find trouble for yourself. How about those people who seem to lack empathy?
Yes, there's a section in the book on self-care around narcissists. Full-blown, we need it, don't we?
It's
very important that people are educated about this because empaths and narcissists have a toxic attraction. And the empath is giving and loving and will stay with them forever in service of their healing. You know, it's not healthy. And then the narcissist sees someone who will give everything and elevate them. And so the full-blown narcissist has empathy deficient disorder. And on one day in April, I talk about just that. How do you deal with empathy deficient disorder? You turn to that day, you read about it. What is it? It's that narcissists don't have the same wiring that we do in terms of being caring and empathic. And that's hard for people who are not narcissists to get that. But once you do, then you won't go running into a relationship with them as readily, even though they're seductive and intelligent and charming and all that, until you create a conflict, which is one of the self-care techniques I suggest with narcissists. Just manufacture some small conflict. Don't go to an event with them, you know, say no to them, and see their response to it, because it won't be good. Hmm. So you can begin to bring out their true colors that way.
Is lack of empathy a treatable condition?
If you're a full-blown narcissist, it's very hard to treat. My psychoanalyst friends say they can treat it if somebody comes 5 days a week, you know, for many years. I know. So the problem with full-blown narcissists is that they're not accountable for anything. If they, let's say, somebody brings in their husband who's a narcissist or their wife that's a narcissist to a session, he will or she will accuse the other person of being the problem. It's not me. It's you that's causing the problem. So they can't be accountable, so you can't really work with them.
Do you ever see or perhaps even do these yourself, brain scans on people who identify as empaths or as narcissists? Is there actually something different in the structure of the brain?
I write a little bit about the science behind being an empath, and it's thought that the mirror neuron system in the brain, the compassion neurons, work overtime in empaths. They work really hard. Really hard all the time, whereas there's a shut-off mechanism in regular people where it's not working so hard all the time. It's not, you know, always feeling compassion for every little thing, every little bird, every little, you know, creature in the world. And so it's thought that the mirror neurons are hypoactive which is very interesting because in empathy deficient disorder or narcissism, it's thought they're hypoactive, meaning they're not working properly.
Are there professions, and we've mentioned psychiatry, that's your profession, that are sort of attract empaths, doctors, nurses, social work teachers, jobs like that?
Oh, yes. The healthcare professions are excellent choices for empaths. And I give workshops for healthcare professionals on how to keep your empathy alive but not absorb the pain and the stress of your patients or the environment. So I work a lot with healthcare practitioners teaching them that. But they flock to the helping professions because they want to help. Empaths love to help. I love to help. But you have to be careful not to become a fixer. There's a self-care technique on how it's impossible to fix other people, although you may want to.
I'm curious, obviously your work is as a psychiatrist, and that's something that you would go through a Western medical education to get to. And then you also say that you work as an intuitive healer, and that's something that would be more seen as a natural or holistic or alternative approach. Why do you want to blend those two traditions in your work?
Well, I want to offer my patients everything possible. And some solutions are good for some patients, some are good for other patients. And so when I have that wide of a range, it really offers people what's best for them and what they resonate with. And so I love that. I mean, being a traditionally trained psychiatrist and trained in medication and the biochemistry of behavior doesn't exclude me having also a deep appreciation for intuition and spirituality and the subtle energies around the body and empathy, developing our empathic skills. So I bring that all together. And for me, it's tremendous fun. It's my passion. And, you know, it offers patients a lot of options.
Do you get pushback in either one of those worlds if you, you know, try to bring a little bit of Western tradition to the intuitive healers or you try to bring the energies and the subtleness to the Western practice? Does either one give you pushback?
Oh, yeah. I mean, both of them do, because there can be rigid people on both sides. You know, the kind that, you know, in intuitive healing that don't want any medication whatsoever for anything, you know, which is a radical stance, and which I don't believe in. And, you know, the other side who believe that it's all woo-woo. So, yeah, they're extremists. But I think, you know, in the last decade or so, with the advent of complementary medicine, functional medicine, yoga, meditation. There's so many physicians who are, you know, taking integrative medicine programs. So it's really much more part of the medical culture now.
Your book is dedicated to Anne Buck. Tell us about her.
Anne Buck is my very good friend, and she's in her late 80s, and she's a mindfulness meditator and a deep, good friend of mine, somebody whose heart is huge as the world, and has been one of those important soul friends that I've had all my life. And so I've wanted to dedicate the book to her.
This is your third book about empathy. The Empath's Empowerment Journal was your first, your self-care companion, the Empath Survival Guide, Life Strategies for Sensitive People, and now Thriving as an Empath with daily self-care notes for, 365 days of self-care for sensitive people. This is a cause of yours.
It is. It's my passion. I want to bring empathy out in people because I believe that empathy, even if you don't like someone or agree with somebody, it allows you to at least see their viewpoint so you have some place to work with to find a compromise. And I think in terms of the world stage and in terms of our families and our work situations, we need to learn how to do that, and it means getting beyond the ego to something larger, to the sense of truly wanting to communicate with someone, even if you know, are very different than they are. It's a beautiful trait. I believe that empathy is going to save the world. I think it is that important. That's why I've devoted my many years to writing about it, and I've developed this trilogy of books, The Empath Survival Guide, now Thriving as an Empath, and then the Empath Empowerment Journal.
Do you have some tips that would be specific to empaths navigating a world of social media and 24-hour cable news?
That's a great question. Because many empaths care so much, they become addicted to the news, and that could be very damaging because of the constant onslaught of stress. I suggest taking technology fasts, news fasts, go out in nature, you know, be with a loving friend, have tea with somebody, you know, just share some positive love with somebody rather than staying glued to all that fear and negativity. It's one thing to be informed. It's another thing to be addicted. And so, like anything else, you know, we need balance. And if you notice you're getting exhausted from the news and starting to feel hopeless or depressed, please stop. Turn off your computer. Get off the screen. Turn off the television. And get back to real life, which is, you know, your life right in front of you, the moment. Whatever your situation is, your family, your friends, take a walk. You know, connect to yourself again. You know, really stay true to your own values so you don't begin to lose faith.
Well, in a lot of ancient societies and now in ones that don't necessarily operate within the Western modern traditions, where people who we might call empaths might also be called shamans or healers or medicine men and women. And oftentimes they're isolated in a good way from the rest of that group.
Right. Yeah. Empaths love isolation. You know, a lot of them love to be alone, love solitude, love being with nature, because then you could commune with yourself in spirit a lot, you know, a lot more easily than with all the hubbub. But if, you know, in Taoism, they call being in the world the middle path, you know, being able to be in touch with your empathic and spiritual values and be in the world. So, you know, that's the path that I've chosen. Because I want to try and make a difference in the world. But yes, the great healers of all time, you know, throughout history, many have been empaths.
Dr. Orloff, do you have your book in front of you by any chance?
Yes, it's close by. I could get it.
Well,
what would you like me to do with it?
Well, you recommend that people read in sequence for a year, and you have 365 self-care days in your book. So I'd like you to open up to today and read what you recommended people read.
Absolutely. As each day is a different self-care technique. 22nd today. Let me go to October 22nd. This is exciting. This is my book launch day, so this is exciting. I am enough. We all have periods when we question ourselves. At these points of self-doubt, when you may not feel attractive enough or smart enough, or successful enough, or even spiritual enough, repeat the following affirmation. Then be ready to shed your fears and recognize the caring, worthy person that you are. Eleanor Roosevelt said, "No one could make you feel inferior but yourself." And then I have an affirmation that you repeat. I am enough. I don't have to prove my worth to anyone. I don't have to be someone I'm not. I don't have to pretend I'm not sensitive or smile when I'm unhappy. I am pleased with myself. I love myself. I am grateful for the opportunity of my life.
And then you have a set your intention.
Yes, I do. And the set your intention will be, I will keep awakening to my best self. I will not see myself as inferior or superior to anyone. I am enough by simply being me.
So these are healing words to a psychiatrist.
Yes, they are. And they're such true words for everyone listening. All of that is about you. It's true. Anything else is untrue. You are enough. You don't have to prove your worth to anyone. You don't have to smile when you're unhappy. You don't have to do any of that. You know, what a relief when I work with people and they realize, no, I really don't, and they stop doing it. It's such a relief.
It's hard to convince people that saying no to something just means saying yes to something else.
Yes, that's right. It takes practice. And so, you know, as a psychiatrist and as an author, I like to handhold, you know, my patients and my readers. I like to walk them through it because it's all about self-compassion, isn't it? It's when you do this healing work, if you're sensitive and a loving, caring person, you want to nurture that. And that can get, you know, kind of damaged sometimes, or you get frightened, or the world just seems like too much. And so thriving as an empath is a balm for you. You know, hopefully it's, you know, taking you into some loving arms and, you know, guiding you to some positive ways of thinking about your life.
Yeah, we've framed this conversation a bit on the negative side of being an empath. So if you could just end
right.
with, what are your favorite things about being an empath?
Well, I've got to say, I love being an empath. I would not trade it for anything. My connection to nature, my depth of my intuition and connection to friends and loved ones, my patients, my connection to myself and my spirituality, which is very deep in empath, and just the joy of enjoying things so much and you know, being able to appreciate life and all of its beauties and even the challenges of life. But you're there 100%. You know, I'm in my body. I'm in my heart. I'm not just in my head. When you're in your head, that can turn into a prison sometimes. So you don't want to do that. You want to be in your mind, body, and spirit.
Psychiatrist Dr. Judith Orloff is the author of the new book, Thriving as an Empath, 365 Days of Self-Care for Sensitive People. She also has Dr. Orloff's Empath Support Community, and you can find out more about that and her books at Dr. Judith Orloff. Orloff is ORLOFF.com. Thanks for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Podcasters, ready, places, and action.
Hi, I'm Prairie Public Director of Radio, Bill Thomas, but I also direct our podcast.
Now, every father can break through to his son using the Father-Son Podcasting Microphone.
Yeah, we've got plenty of home-cooked podcasts for you to subscribe to. You want to bone up on Aristotle? Then subscribe to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, hosted by UND Philosophy Professor Jack Russell Weinstein.
What's wrong with that argument?
Get to know the quiet, poetic grace of people, past and present, who make up our hearty region through Tom Esern's Plainsfolk essays.
Most of all, I'm thinking about that toothy fish.
And then there's the fascinating and diverse roster of guests on our daily statewide conversation convergence, Main Street. The belly laughs and fun culinary insights of Sue Balcom on Main Street Eats.
We're getting chickens, but don't tell them that, okay?
Breaking Barriers, a Red River Rainbow Seniors LGBTQ podcast. And then there's the always popular and shareable Dakota Date Book. You can subscribe to any one or all of these Prairie Public podcasts through Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, NPR One, or wherever you like to get them.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcasts anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.